Hello and welcome to not We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast, Shoot the Piano Player, a French New Wave podcast, or in French, Salut, bienvenue à Tir sur la pianiste, une nouvelle vague française podcast.
No, I don't think that's how they say it in French. I don't know how they say it in French.
It was close enough. I mentioned in the previous season I was learning French, and I want to prove that, like, yeah, I am learning French. I'm not great at it.
You wanted to show the progress you were making by showing that you've made almost no progress.
Yeah, I've made...
Okay.
I actually took the time to learn a little bit.
Yeah.
It's to the point that, like, if I look up, if I see, like, the French poster of a movie, I can figure out what the French title is.
Oh,
in some
cool
cases, which is pretty cool, because sometimes, what was it? Rough Cut Shirts did a shirt for a movie we will cover, pretty early on ish, maybe midway through, Daughters of Darkness, because it's French, and I don't want to wait for the Vampire podcast to get to it, so I want to cover it here. And
well, that's
also
understandable.
Yeah, also, like, it's French horror. There's not that much, like, French horror that I've seen that I want to cover, like, this more as much horror as I can. The French title is as like The Red Lips, and so when I look at the poster, I was like, that does not say Daughters of Darkness at all. And I knew enough French just, like, after a couple months of Duolingo to know that. So I am making progress.
Sure.
It's like Le Something Rouge. I can't remember the word for
Le Lipso Rouge.
Something like that.
I see.
Okay, so this is a French New Wave / Italian season. Not Italian neorealist, because the neorealist movement seemed to have been over by the
French period that you want to talk about, basically.
Yeah, because it started like mid-40s, like post-World War II, and then by the time you get to like La Strada, which we'll cover pretty soon, you know, it's kind of not around anymore, because, like, we'll get to it in the La Strada episode, but, you know, La Strada kind of infinitely kind of changed things for Italian film for the better in some ways.
Yeah, that asshole Fellini did. Yeah.
But so French New Wave, can you remember how you first heard of it?
Yeah, I want to say it was my college, the few college classes I took that were film related, because I don't think it was something I would have, like, heard out of context or anything like that, like in high school or something. I didn't know the cool kids that were watching the hip movies, but I also think, you know, it could have been from Sarah, because Sarah was into, like, some French New Wave stuff way before I even knew what it was. And, but I want to say, now I do think it was in my film class, because that's in one of the film classes I had, we watched Umberto D, and it, ooh, like, blew my mind. I was like, holy crap, that's not the French New Wave, that's the neorealist, right? But yeah. I think I started looking into, like, all the other movements that, like, were loosely surrounding that, and, like, other places that had done this neorealist thing, and we get into the French stuff, basically, from there.
Hmm.
But, yeah, not sure. What about you?
I think it was in the book Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, which I know now is seen as, like, gossip horseshit, which it is. I'm not going to argue that. I don't know what is and isn't true, but they're talking about the new Hollywood, like American wave or whatever, with like the young directors like Friedkin and Altman and all. Well, Altman was around all that. He was like the old man of that era, whatever. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Hal Ashby and all them. And so that's how I learned about like Friedkin and Hal Ashby and, well, I knew Friedkin before that, but like Hal Ashby and Altman and I learned like a new respect for Lucas reading that, and like, and I think it's, they're talking about Friedkin maybe and like Paul Schrader, and they were into French New Wave. I feel like it was those guys who were into French New Wave, and maybe Bogdanovich, and that's how I was like, okay, what's this French New Wave thing? And I randomly started watching a couple Godard movies, because I was like, oh, this is French New Wave, and well, if you've heard my opinion on Godard before, you know, like, they didn't really click with me. It took until I saw Shoots a Piano Player, where I was like, oh, I should watch these movies more. I don't think he sucks, I just don't get it. And I even, because in the past few months, I have been watching, because Kino always has, like, a sale, so I've been getting, like French and Italian movies that we're going to cover through them when they're on sale, and so I've been, like, watching through a lot of them, and I've, on Criterion Channel, I bit the bullet and watched another Godard I hadn't seen yet that we're going to get to in a little bit. Two or three things I know about her, and my streak of not getting it continues.
Wait, so you watched two or three things?
Yeah, voluntarily.
That's one of my favorite movies, so.
Oh. Yeah, hopefully you can explain it to me. It's yet another Godard of, like, I just don't get it.
Yeah, probably not. I probably won't be able to explain it to you. I haven't been able to explain it to anyone else, so. Anyways.
It's not as, like, I don't know. Breathless is coming up pretty soon, so I can get into that. But, like, Breathless was, like, the one I really struggled with of, like, okay, it's influential, but I just kind of don't care about this. You know what I mean?
I don't think it has to be any more complicated than that.
But the other French New Wave I've seen, like, well, I should clarify. So there's the Cachet du Cinéma directors, like Eric Rohmer, Godard, Claude Gerber, Jacques Rivette, and François Truffaut. And I haven't seen any Rohmer yet, but I've seen like four or five Godard, a couple Chabrol. I'm still learning French, and I'm still like kind of iffy on like how I pronounce certain things.
What movie? I mean, did he do
The Third Lover, which is very good. Because that's usually considered, like, the first official New Wave.
Okay, I see his name. I would say Claude Chabrol. I mean, Chabrol. Usually you drop the last letter.
Yeah. I just watched another one he did that I really liked. I just can't remember what it's called. It's early 60s. I remember one. Le Beau Serge is the one that's considered like the first one, and that's a really like great touching movie, and The Third Lover is one from early 60s. I have a couple others of his that I'm really looking forward to getting to when we get to it. But Rivette, I've seen The Nun, which is a devastating but really great movie, and then his 4-hour like epic about art and like the obsession and like the and like what like the passion for art can do to you as a person, which is pretentious, and movie is very pretentious in certain ways, and it's not trying to hide it, but I also really got into it, and it's 4 hours long, which...
I mean, we'll have to get into what the idea of pretentious even means, because, like, when I think of things that are pretentious, I think that somebody would have watched the movie that we're going to be talking about and say that was pretentious, and it's like, this person literally filmed real life. What's real life? What's pretentious about real life? You know, I think it's like an understanding or a non-understanding, or you know, like, I feel like pretension comes in to play usually when people are worried about seeming intellectual or feeling unintellectual, you know what I mean?
And also Truffaut, you know, is the other big one who we named the this season after one of his movies, because Chutepion player is so far my favorite new wave one, French new wave I've seen, because that's like, it's like, that's a great intro to it, and that, and watching that kind of spurred a moment a few years ago, kind of got me into like, okay, maybe I should watch try and get other ones, because like the first few I saw were Godard, kind of like, not kind, like kind of on accident, because it's like, oh, this is French new wave, I'll watch this, and then every time it'd be like, oh, it's another Godard, great.
I mean, he did, he's done a lot of movies. He's no Takashi Miike, but, you know, who is?
Yeah. And there's also the Left Bank group of people who were not associated with the magazine, who are, their big difference with them is, a lot of them were not as, well-versed in movies and, like, referencing Western and, like, Hollywood movies. So... not Western, but like Hollywood, like American cinema. So it's like Chris Marker is lumped in there, which I didn't know he did more than just that one short film.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the man, but he's made one of my most favorite films or whatever of all time, Le Jetty, so...
Yeah, he gets lumped in there. Agnes Varda is Left Bank... And her husband Jacques Demy is a Left Bank guy, and Elaine Vernet, who's the editor on La Pointe Court.
Oh yeah, I saw that. I was gonna say something.
Yeah. We have a upcoming guest who will be which.
Wait a minute! I don't have 3.5 hours.
Oh, you can watch it in chunks. That's how I watch the 4 hour Rivette movie. Watch an hour a night. There's a, like, I think a 5.5 hour. There's a 5.5 hour one he did, and there's like a 12 hour movie he did. And I really want to see all of them, but.
Yeah, I'm just going to go watch Satan Tango.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, so, like, what. Can you remember how you first heard of French New Wave? Or is it this kind of a thing, once you go into movies, it's like, oh, French New Wave, and it's just kind of a thing people talk about?
I'm not sure. You know, it could have been something that people were, like, talking about in high school that was, like, way over my head, for all I know. I feel like the first time I really recognized it was something was when I took those college classes, and... I can't remember if we ever watched one in one of the classes, but I was like, when Hulu had the Criterion Channel, I was just like going through movies like kind of randomly, and I watched, that's when I watched two or three things I know about her. I watched Vagabond, and God Created Woman. That's another one that I really love.
Oh, I think Vadim is a Left Bank guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's lumped into that one.
Sarah already knew about the Umbrellas of Cherbourg and things like that, so I don't know. She probably knew about French New Wave before I even did.
Oh.
So, you know, I've seen 400 Blows, you know, like the ones that are like, well, this is French New Wave, you have to know about this, or whatever. Cleo from 5 to 7, Young Girls of Rochefort. and Donkey Skin because you told me to.
Oh, yeah, I guess that is technically one.
Mm. And even, on Please Don't Send Me Outer Space, the sci-fi podcast, we watched Alphaville with a guest.
Random. Watched it. I think his movies are still on Amazon Prime, but I don't remember.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think the most recent new one I saw was, let's see, in this list it has Eyes Without a Face on there, which I guess is New Wave, but yeah, I didn't think it was.
George, what's his last name? It starts with an F. Left bank person. He's considered one of them. He also did, I think, Purple Noon. And, a couple other big ones.
Oh, yeah. I've seen Purple Noon, too. I think.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the first Ripley movie.
Right.
That was made.
Yeah.
But, for me, I first heard French New Wave because I knew the name Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut kind of early-ish when I got into movies. I can't remember how. I think maybe it would have been Truffaut first because of my favorite Spielberg movie is the Aliens one. Not E.T., the other Aliens one where Truffaut is in it. As a NASA scientist or something.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah. And then I read the book that is maybe horseshit, maybe not. What was that book called? Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, which kind of talked about French New Wave here throughout it. And that got me okay, maybe I should watch French New Wave. And that book was even though it's very basic in film history and in in first cinephiles in general, but for me at the time it was mind-blowing because that's how I learned about Hal Ashby, and that got me watching checking out Sam Peckinpah and stuff like that, and also maybe respect George Lucas a little more because whatever, we don't have to talk about, but and so that book kind of was for me kind of integral to me getting more into movies and learning more about the actual history. And but so that would have been the first time I would have seen the term French New Wave and talking about the Spielberg and Friedkins who were super into Godard and all that.
Yes. No, I don't. So movie.
Yeah, so this is a 1954 pairing, although LaPointe Court is listed as 1955 in some places. Maybe, I think in the features on Criterion Channel, I think she said that's when it got released, because it took a little bit. She had trouble finding a distributor who got what she was trying to do.
Hmm.
But, so it's 1954, so I have an excuse to watch, La Strada, which will be an, other pairing, because it's...
You could just pair whatever movie you want, you know, you don't have to.
Yeah, well, I want to have some organization.
We are the rule makers.
There are going to be a couple down the road that's that are kind of bullshit, but it's kind of hard to find a year, so I'm going to pick this random Italian movie that I like to pair with instead.
Sure.
So, technically, usually Claude Jabrot is considered the first French New Wave guy, but if you want to be technical about it, it was Agnes Varda with LaPointe Court. She really laid the tracks for what was going to happen.
It says it was proto, basically. People from the New Wave saw this and were like, oh, yeah, hell yeah, let's do this too.
Yeah, and she, Agnes at first wasn't as productive because it was a couple, there's a pretty big gap between this and I think her next movie was Cleo.
5 to 7, yeah.
Yeah. Which I think either...
So
either,
that was 62, so...
Yeah, it would have been... Yeah, I actually want to check something. Okay, I was what I thought, because she had had her first kid in between those two movies also.
Mm.
So maybe, like, she took time off to, like, be a responsible parent.
But, perhaps...
Yeah, perhaps. I just heard an interview. I forgot the name of the podcast. I might insert it later. With Cynthia Rothrock, and she stopped doing movies for a while because she had a kid and was and just wanted to be a stay-at-home mom and, you know, do that stuff and make sure that you know, she can take care of her baby.
And sure. She had enough money. Bunch of those people that get in her way rather than for movies.
Yeah. And then after she and her husband got divorced and her daughter was a teenager, she's like, oh, I can do movies again. And she did.
Mm.
But
she did Martial Law 1 and 2.
Which is on Blu-ray on sale right now with Vinegar Syndrome. Which I'm holding out on Tiger Claw trilogy on Blu-ray. Martial Law is just fine.
You should just contact Brett Anderson on Twitter. I'm sure he's interested. He'll get that stuff made.
Yeah, I want him to do Pinky Violence stuff because that's up their alley.
And I don't want to hear what your fantasies are.
Okay. They'd be perfect for releasing some Pinky Violence stuff because, like, no one else seems interested. And that's
sure.
Totally what they're... Anyway, so Yellow Point Court, 1954. This is basically... It's two stories. It's a story of a town, this like French Southside town near the Mediterranean, and it's the life of the fishermen and the wives and the children and the cats. And then other stories, the two lovers who I couldn't figure out if they're husband and wife for a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were just like two lovers who like I thought it was a situation kind of like those. The Texas director guy, that trilogy of movies he does every 10 years.
What the hell are you talking about?
Linklater, that trilogy he does like every 10 years or so, adds a new one.
Before series, you mean?
Yeah, I thought it was like about that type of situation of like they kind of randomly, you know, ran into each other, and. You know, sparks happened, and you know then
right.
They maybe try rekindle it. I didn't realize they were supposed to be married for a while.
I mean, are they married?
In the bonus features, I didn't write down her name, but this like film writer person said they were married.
Oh, okay. Well. I just knew they. I mean, he said they'd been together for 5 years, and living away from here. Like he left this place to go or there, and he met her. They'd been together for 5 years, and they've never came to where he grew up.
Oh yeah, because like this is I'll get this that way first. Like this does feel like a first movie. In certain ways of like some details just aren't very clear, which I don't think is necessarily part of the point she's trying of like what she's trying to get across there necessarily, or maybe I'm just not used to her style because I haven't seen this is the first Varda I've seen. She's just one of those big blind spots of like I'll get to it eventually. I don't know when that is, but. You know, I'll get to it at some point.
Well, at least she's not making movies anymore. We can catch up.
Yeah. And there's no way in hell I'm buying that box set.
You should.
I don't have that kind of money, and I'm...
Oh. I guess that's a good reason.
Yeah. If I could spend that type of Criterion money, I would, but...
Sure. Get the Godzilla set.
There are other people I'm waiting out for, hopefully, to do one.
Zatoichi. The Lone Wolf and Cub. Anyways, I didn't think this was felt like particularly a first film to me. This is different than Cleo 5-7, though. Like, that is way more, feels more like a narrative, even though it's, I think it's a real time movie, which is different anyways, but it is about what Cleo's day is. But this one, you know, like that mix of basically what feels like documentary footage with some dramatization going on in the background, and then this what's the word I'm looking for? It's the love story going on is like a different movie, but it's because it's the couple's movie as opposed to the movie that Varda had made.
Yeah.
Or the town or whatever, if you want to say.
Yeah, which is a real town and real people. Although they were dubbed over because she had to record without sound. And apparently they were upset when they finally saw the movie.
Like, I don't sound like that at all.
Yeah. Where is that? Oh, so I'm not sure if you knew this, but Varda is one of those people who claims she didn't really watch movies. Or I think she said she had never watched movies at all before she made this. Which is like... I don't know if I believe that necessarily.
So she's like Xavier Dolan or Paul Schrader or...
Paul Schrader, I understand, because he came from like a crazy Christian sect family.
Sure. And like this could have been true for her. I mean, we're talking the 50s here. I mean, I know that movies exist, but you're still not inundated with them in a way, and like maybe she just wasn't into it. But it does sound weird to be like, but I'm gonna make a movie.
Yeah. It's just like, this is the first movie you make. It's like, it feels like you've seen a couple like more conventional movies inside. No, I want to do something different.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's also another way you could be like, I didn't know how to make a movie, so I just made this. And that could just come into editing, right?
Yeah.
But that might explain... when it comes to realism, they don't have to be good actors, but the couple who are actually legitimate actors, I think. I know the woman's been in a bunch of other movies.
And the guy was like, came from theater.
Yeah. Like, they are being theatrical, speaking of that, in a way. And it's like, if first-time director didn't know that's not what she wanted, like a stage production as opposed to a film production, like you could see, especially if we were to compare it to Cleo from 5-7, how the actors are different. You know, now in Cleo she has actors that are film actors as opposed to... you know, theater actors that are like, you hold yourself in a position for the shot and then you act out the lines or whatever.
Yeah. And the town La Pointe Court, because this movie is kind of about class quietly, because like there's the woman in the couple, I'm not sure if I even wrote down their names.
Their names are Man and Woman.
Okay. then I wasn't missing something. Okay.
Her and him. Sylvia Montfort was her, and Philippe Noir. It's noir, but it has a T.
I'm not sure.
Yep.
It might be noir, regardless.
Mm-hmm.
But during World War II, Agnes, her family, hid out at the in La Pointe Court just to get away from like the major, get away from Paris and the major metropolitan areas where there's a lot of Nazi presence. And so she knew the area pretty well. She knew the locals. And she just became fascinated with, like, their dialect and their turns of phrases and this their daily, like, day-to-day life stuff. Which really does show, because it doesn't feel exploitive of, like, look at this crazy little town. That's this crazy little country town. It's like, Tria's like, no, this is just, like, how they live.
Yep.
And, like, it really does feel like you're, you know, just living in this French village off the coast of the Mediterranean.
Yeah. I think how the things that are important to them or the kind of things that they're talking about, like, like getting plagued by the police or sending off for results that they think are going to help them, but they don't. It's like, yeah, what do these scientists know? Like, well...
Yeah.
All they know is their only livelihood is fishing, and the fishing's easier in the place that they're not allowed to fish. You know?
Yeah, and... where was it? And there's a point in the movie where it's like, wait, is this a flashback or a fantasy when they do, like, the jousting? Because, like, it feels so out of place because it's so plain and just, like, working... Nah, that sounds classist, but I don't mean to be classist. But, like, looks so plain, like, you know, like, working class and, like they don't have time for, like, a big celebration. Like, they're more concerned with, like, just, you know, surviving because, like, it's clearly an impoverished area, and there's not that much talk about it being impoverished, but you see, like, the conditions of some of the houses and some of the, you know, what some of the people have, in particular the woman with, like, all the kids. You see the one kid sleeping in a drawer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, and then you see, then we get to that part, it's like, so I was thinking, like, wait, is this, like, a fantasy sequence, a flashback to Paris, and then I realized, oh, it isn't. It's just like their yearly tradition, or something.
I mean, it's not not even yearly. It's like, I think they say, like, I don't know if they said weekly, but they it seemed like this something. Is like no something that happens very often.
Yeah, it happened regularly enough that, like, you know, there was a. You know, like you know who's gonna joust. You know who the good jousters are. You know, you don't get much of it, and it's pretty cool to watch just the jousting, like on those ships, which.
I mean, I think part of the classist thing is it feels silly. Like it doesn't feel silly to the characters, but like you can't help but feel. I mean, it looks silly when you're watching it. Like these people are on. The tall parts of boats doing the jousting, you know, to knock the other person off the boat. And they've got shields, they've got the things, and people have to be down there rowing. You know, it's not like motorized or anything like that to give them the speed and the angle or whatever. It's like, this is a silly production, but everyone's having a great time, so who cares?
Yeah. And
it is, like, since she's from the city, it's like, oh, this is what people have to do around here for fun. That's crazy.
Yeah. And apparently they're a lot. Apparently, a recurring thing with Varda is you see cats in a lot of her movies. And this movie is full of cats, and it was so comforting to see all these like stray cats hanging out. Even though I try not to think about it too much because like you don't know what those locals are doing to those cats, like how they try to get rid of them. Well, you hear about some of it. But at the same time, it's like, oh, it's a cute little cat. And so, like, that always kept me interested. It's a very dumb thing to say, but, like, never mind.
No, it's fine. They are cute. And I think that the way that they're outside, the way that they obviously don't belong to anyone, some people like them. Most people just seem to ignore them. You know, they're just living in a fishing village so that they can get fish when they want, and you know, unrefrained breeding means more cats all the time, and to the point where I think that was probably bothered you more, surprisingly, seeing that cat who had drowned didn't bother me as much, not because I had seen this before we watched it for the show, but also it just feels like a natural conclusion. Like, there's so many cats around. They're literally surrounded by water. It's terrible, but it's also understandable.
Yeah, when that scene happened, I was like, is Freya fighting with Wednesday? And then I replayed it like, oh, what happened, what I thought happened really did happen. And recently at work, I was saying, off record, I had to remove a dead cat from a client's basement because the person is in a wheelchair, can't get in the basement, so I need to do it. And it's not pleasant or fun to have to like remove a and it had been there for a couple days. It was already like stiff and like stuck to a couch, and I won't go into much detail of that, but like just you know, it's not a pleasant thing to deal with, even though, like, you know, like, if you think about it, like, point court, like, the people there are probably used to it, because there's so many cats around, and it's like, well, they're gonna get into places they shouldn't be getting to, and, you know, nature happens, and it's Astrea's like, well, that's life.
Right. And is life, like, everything passing by, everything that happens in the movies is life. I think it's interesting that you can't really tell how much time this takes place in. Like,
I assumed it was a week.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we don't get a definite night and day sequence. We get a couple of times where it's definitely like the evening, but we don't, you know, there's no like waking up in the morning, breakfast kind of thing, or definitely we're going to bed tonight or something. Yeah. It's almost, you know, we see them in the morning when he gets ready to go get her at the train station, and then the movie ends at the night at the end of that party.
Yeah, it opens.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's an Ozu opening. I wasn't sure I said that earlier. With like the credits over, this is still image of what looks like just like a piece of wood, but it goes from like that the Ozu style opening to just like where Ozu, like, it's just part of the artifice of like what he's trying to of like his style, where this is like it pulls out and it's this long tracking shot, and it's like, oh wait, this is part of the world, and it's just a really cool engaging way to just get your attention immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see the layout of like the town, and just see all the people, and you get introduced to the fisherman and like the young daughter, not young daughter, she's probably like 20-ish, daughter of that one guy who's in love with the one fisherman.
They were saying she was 15.
They were saying that?
Yeah, they said that she was too young to be considered getting married. That's why it's okay for dad to still slap her full in the face.
Okay, like
multiple times.
She said mom was 19 when she got married, so I thought that meant she was 19.
Oh, no, I think.
Okay.
That's what they were saying, like, yeah, I know it's early, but blah, blah, blah.
Okay, I missed that detail. I thought that they're saying, like, she just turned 19.
I could be totally wrong, but I think I don't know. That's the thing.
Yeah, and
jailbird boyfriend.
Yeah, Raphael. Was it Raphael? Ralph? I forgot.
I don't know.
But, I like the location. It's just I don't know if you can visit there, but I would like to just, like, visit there and just see if it's still like that. It just seems like this, I don't know, like, this, it just seems like so calm and peaceful, and just, I don't know, it's just like, it feels like a place the movie just made me interested, like, oh, I want to go to a place like this, and just, like, hang out.
You're living in the lover's fantasy world, where it is calm and peaceful, and like, yeah. Oh, what an existence. Me, I was like, that place smells.
Yeah, probably.
It smells like the ocean and the fish and the dead animals on top of the fish, and all these guys smell because they're not bathing. I mean, you know, there's no showers or anything, you know, right? Everything you get from the ocean, that's, what else do you need?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a stink. It's a stink town.
Yeah. But, a similar note, the vacation spot in Mr. Hulot's Holiday, is a real vacation spot you can still visit, and there's a statue of Jacques Tati, there, because he filmed that movie there.
Uh-huh.
But that's an actual vacation spot, not like just some random small village. But I bet those people know how to make some good, like, seafood salad and, like, some seafood soup. Because, like, seeing all those eels and the fish, like, this got me, like, I got hungry watching this movie. Like, oh, I wonder what they're going to make with all that.
Yeah, nobody eats anything either. At least I can't think of it.
We don't see it, but...
It's like in between all the small moments, the only time I can think of... I think there might have been food on the table in the house where all the kids were, but, you know, it wasn't... More worried about the sick kid in that house than feeding him.
Yeah. And the kid storyline, that was very, I didn't expect it to go that sad. Like, cause like the village life part is like this, you know, kind of neorealist, like kind of like aping, the Sika. Just because I'm trying to think of kind a little bit, and I didn't expect it to like, cause, like, part of me was thinking, like, okay, well, these two very different stories will merge in some way, and they kind of do, but not really, cause I thought part of me was expecting, like, Cairo Station, where it's going to be like, okay, maybe she's doing this just to build up to, like, a interesting conclusion, incorporating everyone. And, like, somehow they're going to save the kid from dying, and, you know, and, like, the young woman will be with the man she wants him.
I don't believe you. I don't believe you thought this.
Early on, like, the first 30 minutes or so, I was like, okay, well, it'll just come together in some way. And then then halfway through, it's like, okay, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to run into any plots during this series.
I really did think it was going to all come together somehow.
It's going to be like 8.5. They're all going to march in front of the camera. Singing and dancing or whatever. No, it's just supposed to be like this slice of, like, things happen, a thing that can happen in this the village thing. I felt like the kid getting sick and dying had the most false feeling to it. Like, you know, the all the fisherman stuff and the being patrolled because of bacteria thing, it all had like this feeling of authenticity to it. But the child going, like, if it was a week, the child went from not feeling good to won't get out of bed, so call the doctor, to the doctor being like, yep, there's nothing we can do, why don't you call me earlier, like, what, 2 days earlier? And then some the ladies in there with the dead kid, the none of the brothers and sisters care. And they bring in some old lady to go, hi, hi.
Yeah.
That woman was a terrible actor. No.
Oh, it's, this movie shows how location affects people, which this was like halfway through a movie, which I'm not sure what I meant by that. I think it may be in terms of this, like, the couple kind of talking out like what they're gonna do, like if they're gonna stay separated or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And like just being in this like slow moving country town away from Paris is like their version is like giving them an excuse to just like things are so slow moving there, like they can actually take the time to have this like borderline philosophical discussion about their love.
Well, it's not even, they're on a different planet, and like based on what the guy is saying, this isn't the first time they've played this particular game where it's like, am I going to leave? Should we be together? Do you love me too much? Do I love me too much? What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. You know, and it's like, I see it from the viewpoint of the people at the towards the end who are like, they're never going to be happy. They talk too much or whatever they say. It's like, yeah, if I just saw these people acting like this, I'd be like, what are these silly freaking people doing? Like, that guy used to live here. Why is he acting weird? Why is she acting? You know what? Never mind. It's the juxtaposition with the neorealism stuff makes that so interesting in a way that, like I said, if somebody was like, this part, this is pretentious. Like, I guess that part can feel pretentious, but it's not, it doesn't feel like they were trying to say anything like profound or anything like that. They thought it, you know, Agnes Varda thought it would be an interesting juxtaposition or something like that.
Yeah, it came from the Faulkner book, Wild Palms, because it's a story of, it's two separate stories that never connect.
Mm.
And so she just came like real interested in an idea and was like, well, I should make a movie kind of centered on that idea.
I mean, there's this, that's just, I feel like there are like six or seven different stories and none of them are touching, but we're focusing more on the couple than any of the other separate stories, and that's why it stands out more.
Yeah, and where is it? Yeah, like at an interview from like 10 or so years ago, she was just talking about, okay, I didn't have it here. She says it's neorealist, but she kind of insinuated she had never seen any neorealist movies. She just kind of had heard of neorealist movies at the time. And so that's just kind of like her approximation of like how to do that type of movie.
Weird.
Again, that's what she said, but, also, like what I was getting to earlier about the whole French New Wave thing, and what means, like, she broke the system because she was 25, just wrote the script and became interested in, like, wanting to make this movie. She never apprenticed under any like major directors or producers or whatever in the studio system. She just kind of taught herself, you know, how to do it, and you know, she did it, and she got 10 million francs to make it, which sounds like a lot, but the typical studio film would took 150 million francs. And so basically she could only have two real actors appear in it. The rest were locals.
Locals that she didn't pay, yeah.
Yeah, that she didn't pay. And they were okay with it because, like, they recognized she was doing hard work and they appreciated that she was just kind of documenting their life and their way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. The best parts of this movie feel like the documentary because somehow being black and white, like, because she doesn't know, like, the 180 rule or whatever it is, and, like, at what point, you know, there's supposed to be that imaginary space between the actors and the camera, and, like, that is the way it is with the movies, but when things cross between, you know, what we're supposed to be watching and what's going on, like, the, you know, the people just dragging pieces of wood or the poles that they use and the boats and things like that, it gave it this, like, 3D feeling that is like very unique. And yeah, it's like, there are some parts of it where it's like, was this movie released in 3D? Almost. It definitely wasn't, but they feel, because of that, it feels tangible. It feels like a real world.
Yeah. And like that, that takes away, like, the pretentiousness, 'cause it doesn't feel, not artificial, but it doesn't feel forced. It feels like this is what it's supposed to be, and not trying to be anything it's not trying to be.
Mm-hmm. It looks like the kind of mistake somebody would say an amateur would make, but it like isn't a mistake. It looks amazing.
Yeah, and where was it? Okay, so I mentioned earlier, this didn't get released in 54. It was at Cannes in 55, and people liked it, and she became, like, the hot new thing. And it took 2 years. Okay, so I'm getting the timeline right. It took 2 years after 1955 at Cannes to get a distributor and actually get to theaters.
Mm.
And it was successful. So, so technically it would have been, so it wouldn't, like, completed, and then, and completed after about a year, and then took 2 years to get released. So it would have been, not that long for her to come back and make another movie, but it's still, compared to, like, Godard, who was cranking out, like, I feel like he made, like, 20 movies in 10 years. Like, he kept somehow getting money, you know, to crank out stuff, and then, like, Truffaut, I mean, worked out
very... The French government will just give you money to make movies.
Yeah, but Varda had, you know, it wasn't as rapid for her.
Right.
At least at first, unless, you know, she kind of was trying to be picky. I don't really know too much about her.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how Godard got, like, what level of, like, visibility he had, you know, having worked on Cahiers de Cinéma.
He and was, things like that. Like, I mean, now he's known for this, like, speaking out about, like, everything that he can. But, like, he was this kind of young, brash, like, film critic who would just say, like, yeah, like, a big personality, and, you know, he could just, like, get attention. He's like,
oh, so he's the Armand White of our age. I see.
Yeah, kind of. In some ways, he's he famously, like, heard on the Pink Smoke podcast, they're talking about political films, and like Godard was at a PREF conference talking about like a movie you want to do based off of like a book based off of Chairman Mao's theories on communism, where like the next question he revealed he never read the book, but he's going to make a movie based off of it.
I mean, you say that like he's the only person to ever do that.
Yeah,
what's the name of Jodorowsky's Doom, for God's sake?
Yeah, but like Godard is he's kind of always been like just like talking out of his ass.
And like, yeah, kind of, it's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. It's like, yeah.
It's like your favorite director, Lars von Trier, does that.
I think Lars does it as a persona bit. We've talked about this too much. I don't know if the persona is the real him, but I kind of don't want to know, because I kind of don't care that much, because if it is, he's kind of a rotten person.
You think it's like a Jekyll and Hyde situation? He like drinks a potion before he does a press conference?
Yeah, and he makes sure to come up with the most offensive thing to say to get attention.
So, this potion's not doing it for me today. I'm going to have to put a clothespin on my testicles.
Yeah. But, so Varda, so she is 25, she was 25 when she shot it, and then, she was called an ancestor and grandma of the new wave when she was 30, which would have been like 1960, when Breathless came out.
Makes sense.
Like, they moved that quickly.
I mean, like artistic movements, film movements, and stuff like that. That's how fast it happens, anyways. Yeah, and it has to. I mean, like the things that felt fresh all of a sudden become old hat.
Yeah, and okay, I wrote down a couple things that bring up, and then in my notes that I forgot to look at. I did mention some of them. Like, I wrote down, did you get hungry with seeing all the seafood?
Which I did not.
You said no, which I don't get that.
I don't eat much seafood. I do eat seafood, but not very regularly.
All right.
Like you said, it wasn't food. They had fish, you know, they were live flapping around fish and quirling around eels.
Well, they're going to eat that food, and I'm sitting there like, I want to know what they're going to make. I'm getting hungry.
Let's just say I was as hungry as I was during the old boy scene where he eats the octopus.
All right. And you see the arms coming out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Not tentacles. Those are arms, if you want to be technical about it.
Sure.
Squid have two tentacles and, I think, six arms. Anyway. I feel like I need to watch it again, but I feel like with all the cats and the animals that you get to see, there was like a sense of like she's trying to like do like a animal, like use the animals as a comparison point. So you have like a couple, so you see like a lot of like the crab traps, and actually I used to work for a guy who would make crab traps, so like I used to know how to make, like, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Like the boxes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to make those for a lawn service I worked at, because when we didn't have lawns to do with crab traps, so like I used to like know, like have it memorized and could make one in like 5 minutes or maybe 10 minutes.
The Delaware crabbers.
No, this guy's a real character that I won't talk about here.
All right,
off record, because Yeah, this guy was.
You're not talking about him here. Come on.
Yeah, I know. But just, you know, the scene. Where was it? I think you got to already. Did you like the opposing styles and stories that was going on?
Yeah. We did basically talk about that. And I think, yeah, like I said, I think the contrast is. It could be jarring or it could be fascinating. Like, to me, it's like fascinating for this. I mean, there's a scene where they're having their casual conversation, like, oh, you love this place. You said you would never leave it. Yes, but I would go anywhere you go. You are my heart. I can't be without you. How could you live without this happiness in your life? And in the background, we see these fishermen that are, like, struggling. And it's like, it's a little silly. Like I said, it is, their whole love is a little silly. And that, and things that happen in the village is silly. Like, I think it's part of the way it is. Even the tragedy things. And you can see, like, a reflection of what I was saying about the cat. You know, like, there are so many cats and inevitably going to happen. You could even think that about the child. You know, there's 6 children. There are so many children. Inevitably, something might happen.
Yeah, they're probably Catholic, so, you know, they're going to have more.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's very universal because it's fishing, which every culture does. You know, the ocean, it's very windy. And you know, it's dealing with, like, love, which is, you. So it's like, all the major, like, things that you see in the movie and they talk about is just these things that, like, anyone anywhere can relate to.
Yeah. That's how it feels. Except for a very, very rich person. They can't relate to normal people.
Yeah. Remember when Bill Gates thought, was asked, like, how much does a hammer cost? He's like, $50?
Did that actually happen?
It wasn't a hammer, but it was, like, something very common that he said, like, was way too much.
Like, who asked him that?
I don't know. Some interviewer, maybe trying to zing him, be like, see, he's not like a normal person. Like, yeah, no shit, he's a billionaire. He doesn't remember what life was like before. Yeah,
he doesn't have to remember. Now, my favorite is still anytime Congress people are like, you people can get by easily on $200,000 a month. I'm like, how much do you think the average person earns, you freak?
Yeah.
$200,000 a month. No, whatever it is.
That's right. That piece of shit Chris Coons shouldn't be in Congress. Should have been Jess. Should have been. I'm not going to talk about the Delaware Senate race.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
I'll say Chris Coons sucks. He's a corporate centralist Democrat. Should have been this progressive who's running. He's basically Biden. He's basically Biden Jr.
Oh, which, okay. So he'll start grabbing people.
You know, like, I mean, he's, like, shorter than Biden, and, like, this old pale white man.
Oh, God, I love old white men.
Yeah, it should have been just young millennial, like 30 something, who was like a Bernie Sanders type.
We're gonna keep on fighting.
Yeah, I know. Should have been Jess, not that piece of shit. It's better than the neo-Nazi who is running for the Republicans here.
Mm.
Which is a story for another time. Look her up. She's a real piece of shit, also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, at least Chris Coons is better than her, which is not saying much. No one listening will care them complain about how much I hate the one of the senators.
Yeah, one of those candidates doesn't like you. The other one hates you.
Yeah. I didn't want to get political. Well, whatever. We will get political in other episodes, probably.
I mean, you were talking about the class difference feeling that sometimes goes on in there. It's kind of, we don't exactly see anything spectacularly different. I feel like maybe the jousting scene is the most like this is obviously not near the fishing village, but it's close enough by that everybody can, you know, go over and participate and eat an ice cream if they have a few extra, you know, whatever. It's like that's a clean looking place, and you get the feeling that maybe like multiple fishing villages in the area all sending representatives to poke each other with sticks on boats.
Yeah. And that feels very Italian, because they mentioned they're close, they're basically on the Mediterranean, so it made me think, like, there must be some cultural crossover with the Italians.
They're all Europeans to me.
Yeah. And, you know, and they, the whole, like, the woman is from Paris, and so it's like, there seems to be, like, a very light theme of cultural crossover.
Yeah.
But it feels like a Jacques Tati movie, which I'm not sure if you've seen any Jacques Tati movies, but it's kind of like this easygoing, like small, small scale feel to things, which are like the early Jacques Tati movies are really just based in like the, this feels like Jacques Tati's first movie, The Big Day, which I can't remember the French title of, which is kind of like this, he plays a mailman who goes on his route in this small village, and just all the people he encounters throughout the day, and then just a bunch of silly gags happen, and you know, he gets drunk and gets home too late and gets stuck in a town. But yeah, you know, it kind of felt like that, and Mr. Hulot's Holiday, and just like, again, she said she didn't watch movies, but like, but some of this feels like, I don't know, maybe like you heard of Jacques Tati and someone described it to you. And like,
I mean, when did Jacques Tati make those movies?
Big Day is late 40s. Hulot's Holiday is like early 50s, like 51 or 52.
Mm-hmm.
He had a bunch of short films in like the late 30s and the early 40s.
Mm.
He'd been around. He was like a trained mime.
I mean, that was like, she was filming something that actually happens, probably. Yeah. It's some silly thing that people actually do. You're not set up for, you know, Jacques Tati living in his fantasy world because he took a bunch of opium. I know what happened.
Yeah, we'll get to him pretty soon, actually. But
all right.
Yeah, he's a fascinating dude. But yeah, so Le Point Court, I like this. One of the things else that's really sticks out is you don't see a lot of things. You don't see when the lovers meet for the first time. You see him go to a train station, and then you see them like at coming back into town. You don't see them like actually greet each other. So like they're it's just interesting, the things that she chooses not to show.
Yeah, you hear about the train station, and not just from there, because that's when what'd you call him, Raphael or something like that?
Yeah, it was like the younger, the guy,
yeah,
the youngest one.
When he's going to be arrested, but he has to go get some stuff, and the police officer says, okay, get your stuff ready, I'll meet you at the train station, which is you know, it's a local guy. He's not going to do anything. And if he does, I know where he lives. Yeah. So this train station is just a place. It's like, okay, if we're going to get somewhere, you go to the train station.
Yeah. And, is there anything else? No, I like this movie. It's not great. It still has like some rough edges to it that don't fully connect, and I can't really explain fully like why I don't think it's great, but like it's a very good like indicator of like, okay, this like Varda is gonna do some interesting things later on, like, you know, like if I saw the time, I would have been like, I want to see what she does next.
Yeah. It has, as somebody who like only watched Hollywood movies until that, you know, taking some film classes and stuff like that, like, I found this movie exciting for being so different and for portraying like life as it actually would be. And on the second viewing, I think I liked it probably about the same. You know, it's like a solid 7 out of 10. not, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone, though. Like, it's not, what level of French New Wave are we talking here? This is at least a mid-level, like, okay, it's, you might find it kind of boring, but it has a lot of good stuff going on in there. Like, yeah, it'll drive away some people, but it won't drive away everybody.
When I put on Twitter that I watched it, one person who on a podcast I will probably would have been on by this point, talking about Darcy Wazala. If you follow my Twitter, the show's Twitter, you can figure out who I'm talking about. Liam, I'm talking about you. I think it's Liam. I can't remember now. Said, like, LaPointe Court is, like, the generic, like, French art film that you see, like, parodied and, like, in TV and movies of, like, has all the elements of, like, how someone on a sitcom or whatever would make fun of a French art film.
Yeah, I feel like the lovers parts definitely are, but I feel like the rest of it isn't like that. But like the whole scenes where it's like half of his face, half of her face, or they're like, you know, album cover facing one of them's facing towards the camera, the other one's facing to the west or something like that. Those parts feel like, yeah, the sad black and white clown.
Yeah, you
know, with the music.
From King of the Hill, that episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is on Criterion Channel. It's in that big old box set for Varda, which we will do another, at least Cleo, and then we're going to do like a separate Varda episode, which I have to actually talk to the guest on that and which movie she picks. Because I'm kind of leaving it up to the guest, because the person is a big Varda fan.
Sure.
But, yeah, so...
Are you sure she didn't say she was a big Varda fan? The DC character from Murder World or whatever it is?
I thought you were talking about Yuri Varda, the Czech stop-motion animator.
No, I was talking about Mr. Miracles... his wife. Never mind. I'm not up to date on anything.
I was reading Suicide Squad, the Adam Glass run, and then it reached a point of like, it started fun, and now it's kind of lost its steam. Once Unknown Soldier showed up, it's kind of like, it's not as interesting as it used to be. I think Adam Glass left the run by that point. Yeah, talking comics from like 6 years ago. Anyway, yeah, this is on Criterion Channel, that big old box that I think maybe separate DVD, I don't know.
It is separate, yeah.
But, yeah, watch this movie, it's good, if you're into this type of stuff. And, our follow-up to this will be Lestrada, the first Fellini movie, giving an excuse to finally watch that. And, in case you're wondering, are we going to do an episode on the first Fellini movie I ever saw? Of course we will. That is Satyricon, which I wonder how you will react to it, because it's real artsy-fartsy and like dreamy and weird. And it's not a beloved one, which makes sense, but I love the source material and is in my favorite, one of my favorite classes ever, my literature class, and the first college I went to, and we watched Satyricon, and no one in the class liked it besides me.
I haven't had one of those moments yet, unfortunately.
No. And we watched A Pillow Book, the 90s movie, which at the time I was like, I don't get this. Why am I seeing McGregor's penis?
That's, yeah. I haven't seen that movie, so.
No.
But I've seen The Man's Penis.
Yeah, in the 90s and early 2000s, he's all about showing it off. Like, yeah, we get it.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah, so Lestrada, that's streaming in places. It's Fellini, you know. It's one of the fans of Fellini, so it's you can get to it. And J-Dog, do you this I'm not sure when this is coming out, probably January-ish.
Uh-huh.
About January. So a vampire podcast, the other thing.
I mean, presumably we'll get that started again sometime, and I'll finish editing that episode, but sure, the Dead Travel Fast Vampire Podcast, eventually we'll get through and move on to Chapter 4 of Dracula, into our new series where we'll be talking about movies like, what was it, the Transfiguration?
Yeah, Martin.
Transfiguration, Martin.
The Claire Denis vampire movie.
High Life.
I wish High Life, but no, Trouble Every Day.
Trouble with the Curve?
Yeah. Has Clinton been in a vampire movie?
Has Eastwood ever been in a vampire movie? I don't think so.
I think the closest to anything fantasy or mythical to him would have been like the spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's in the Iger, whatever it is, he plays a antiques dealer / international spy, I think. That's fiction. Something like that, I can't remember. Iger Sanction.
I know what you're talking about. Okay, for me, by this point, I'll maybe have the couple more things on Red, Black, and Green, a celebration of African history. As of the recording, I just put up the piece on Flora Nawapa. She's a literary legend. Read her books. They're great. And she should be more celebrated, but she's kind of forgotten a little bit now because she died almost 30 years ago now. But she kind of gets, since then she's been way overlooked by her contemporaries like Chinua Achebe, but Nawapa is just as important as Chinua Achebe. And by this point, maybe I have one on the Madagascar's kingdom that ruled for like 300 years or so, and then, or one on Thomas Sankara, or Jibril Diop Mbeti. The schedule is kind of up in the air. It kind of depends on how much information and like or research I feel like doing. So, there will be more. And the Japanese cult cinema thing, there might be something. I don't know yet. So yeah, there's that. And I will have been on Oeuvre Busters maybe by now, talking about Dersu Uzala, because their season is Kurosawa and Mifune, and they're doing bonus episodes on Kurosawa without Mifune. And I told them, well, you have to do Dersu Uzala, and so I will be on that, and that's that. And I have the book Dersu Uzala, so I'm going to plan on reading that, at least starting it pretty soon. And
then you can do your Russian history podcast.
Oh God, no. I would like to, but no, that's too much to dig through, too complex. Anyway, so yeah, watch French New Wave movies, watch Italian movies. You know, be safe and smart. Hopefully, by now. America will be smarter with COVID shit, but I doubt it. The show can be found on Twitter at PianoPlayerPod. Our email is still highandlowpod@gmail.com. You can find a show on Spotify, Podbean, and various other places where you can find podcasts. Our intro music is by Vivian Fopp, and our cover art is by Sarah Roberts. You can find her art, sarahkathleenroberts.com. And thank you for listening.